This is Scan, and I'm Hal Dragseth. This week, Jack Flagler, a former steel worker, on the world of work.
Well, I'm a former steel worker, and I entered the industry like my grandfather and my father before me. I expected that it would be exciting and it would be the rites of passage I would now enter upon full manhood by going into those shops that always sat down along the river in the industrial valley that I came from. And so I look forward to going into the shops. So I forged a birth certificate in order to get into work early. So at age 15, I was in the foundries. And I can remember being young, skinny, scared, and the idea of romance and glamour went out of my mind in a hurry. It was replaced just by terror. So I went down to the shops and was hired because my family had a good reputation in the industry. Hard working immigrant people. And I got a card from the personnel office with the name of the plant manager. And it was like the 40 acres of hell to me, like something right out of Dante. Here were these Bessemer converters roaring as they processed the metal. The cubilos booming as it was melted down. The bleating of vibrating machines as the molds were made. And workers with goggles on their forehead against plant rules, running around with buckets filled with molten metal and shouting, "Hot stuff, kid! Hot stuff! Get out of the way!" I was convinced I was going to be burned up in the first day on the job. The noise was so deafening that to make myself heard, I had to put my mouth right up next to the ear of a workman and I'd shout, "Where's Jimmy Graham?" And he'd point deeper and deeper into the bowels of this shop. And I just kept following the lead until I finally came to this man who was as wide as he was high. And he took a cold, unlit cigar out of his mouth, looked me up, looked me down, and he said, "Kid, they're really scraping the barrel." So that was my introduction to the world of work from the standpoint of how I felt about being a worker and where I fit into the scheme of things. To me, it was terribly threatening. I wondered about my ability to survive. And it was shortly after that, when I was on the job and getting my confidence, that the company bought a new machine. And it was brought out onto the work floor, surrounded by a group of engineers in shirt sleeves and men with green shades over their eyes and clipboards in their hand. They surrounded this machine and they issued all kinds of admiring sounds. They patted it and they stroked it and they issued actually erotic moans about this damn machine. Isn't it a wonder? Isn't it a marvel? The latest, the best, the greatest. Well, in terms of the kind of reception that I'd received, and the kind of reception that that machine received, I never again in my life had reason to seriously question the priority between man and machine in the industrial value system. From that time, I became active in representing workers. I was 17 when I was first elected departmental steward. And again, this was a cause of some anxiety because the workers, by and large, seriously overassess the capacity of the union to bring about significant change. I don't want to diminish the importance of the labor movement. It's contributed enormously. But there is an overassessment on the part of workers concerning what the union can do to humanize work, to make the work experience enriching, rewarding. The union, at best, is an adversary that challenges specific kinds of decisions. And the labor movement is very slowly, and then only in the advance guard of the most creative and energetic thinkers, seeing the union movement as a means for genuinely humanizing work, changing its character. But I expect that if work is going to be really significantly humanized and made rewarding, then the impetus for that change is not going to come from organized labor as such. I think that the impetus is going to come from young people in the world of work. And the impetus is going to come from management taking a correct reading concerning what's going to be necessary to engage the energies of young people to get the work of the world accomplished. People now find that they can be relieved from the drudgery of the worst part of awful work to think about a better life, a rewarding life, a significant role for themselves. We see that expressed in many different kinds of ways in our own experience. A reexamination of values, a willingness to stop to smell the roses and to challenge orthodox wisdom. I think this is tremendously encouraging because people are challenging the way that we do work and the technologies by which we accomplish the necessary work at a human level. They're challenging that at the same time that we recognize in terms of the irreplaceable resources of this planet that we could no longer sustain the present mode of technology even if we wanted to. This technology has to be substantially changed. The so-called mega technology could not last for yet another generation. Surely in terms of the capacity of energy resources and other non-replaceable mineral wealth to feed it.
This is Scan. The way work is done today is largely the creation of a mega technology, according to Jack Flagler, a former steel worker.
Management knows that it must pursue other kinds of options. An intelligent, progressive management will see the technologies which are intermediate are not only sensible, they're essential. Now, what do I mean by an intermediate technology? To borrow the phrase of Dr. Schumacher, author of Small is Beautiful. In my judgment, intermediate technology means creating a congenial relationship between man, nature, and technology. Now, under a mega technology, we have anything but congeniality. There is a hostility. Technology that merely directs itself towards mass production, huge volume, at minimum cost, feeds itself in a kind of dynamic. The dynamic requires that people be turned into consumers as consumers. You have to generate this deep domestic purchasing power pool. People must be encouraged to work hard. Why? To make money. Well, what do you want to make money? So that you can buy the products that have been created by this mega technology. All right, well, now that you've worked hard and you've acquired those products, what do you do? Well, you work harder in order to keep them. And what are you doing now to the so-called free goods of the world? Air we breathe, the water we drink, the mineral wealth that we bring up from the earth. You use it up as quickly as possible. You virtually plunder it. It can't go on very much longer because that whole system of enormous volume, low costs, depletes the significance of work. It trivializes the work itself. It requires that jobs be broken down into smaller and smaller components. And then those components are mechanized. And the mechanization is computerized, and we have automation. And then the automation is sophisticated into more elaborate control systems, which we call cybernation. These seem like just a bunch of words. What they translate out to: mechanization, computerization, automation, cybernation, means trivialization of work, the draining of content out of jobs. Every single perceptive sense can be instrumented and has been instrumented. Well, when a person's capacity, the need for that capacity is eliminated from the job, human judgment is eliminated from the job, hand-eye coordination is taken over by the machine. If the machine can do it faster, swifter than the person, then the machine will do it. And the whole process means that work becomes contentless. Now, the intermediate technology calls for the restoration of opportunities to express human capacity in work. Technology compatible with what human nature is all about as we understand it. A technology compatible with the capacity of the environment not only to sustain it, but to live with it in a reciprocal condition of alliance, in a symbiotic rather than a parasitical relationship. The parasite is the technology, and the land is the victim. The specific forms of intermediate technology which restores content to jobs will mean that we'll have more worker self-governance, more worker self-direction, more team concepts, where the management person will be a coach, a facilitator, a catalyst, a trainer, a much richer role. The manager will be one who releases human energies by assisting workers in the whole process of decision-making on how a job should be done. We can accomplish far more sane society and a richer society, even in terms of sheer physical wealth, by carefully re-examining this whole question of congeniality between workers, equipment, the environment. What are the payoffs? The payoffs are that the work that people do helps determine how they see themselves. And they draw their identity, their sense of worth from that role. Now, as that role has become less significant in a technologized world, people have had to search out other sources of worth. Thankfully for the sanity of society, most people find some other sources. They say, I'm a father, I'm a mother, I'm a Democrat, I'm a Catholic, I'm anchorman on my bowling team. But something that's functional to render an identity and a sense of worth. The fact is that we spend more of our lives in a world of work means that the more significant the work, the more significant is the person that performs it. To exalt the dignity of work is to exalt the dignity of those who do that work. We get insanity in the world of work, you get a sick society. The world of work tells people things about themselves too. We surround our plants with cyclone fences. And that says to workers, this is a kind of prison. It's not still water and it's not San Quentin, but it's a kind of prison. It's to keep people out, but also to keep people in. Now, we have security guards. The security guards look through your purses and your lunch buckets. Sure, on a sampling basis, not everybody gets. But we have security guards in there, and it says to the worker, you're dishonest. Okay? That's why we have to put a fence around you, because you'd wander off and not do the work unless we put a fence around you. And we don't do a sample check of your lunch buckets and your purses, then you'd steal us blind. Now, you know, we've got time clocks. You know what time clocks tell the workers? You're irresponsible. If we didn't check you in and check you out, you'd arrive late and leave early. Now, we've got inspectors. The inspectors, they say, well, you're kind of dumb, you know. If we didn't check your work, it wouldn't be worth a damn. And so here's all of these external symbols that tell workers you're lazy, shiftless, irresponsible, dishonest. And we'd contradict all that with some nonsense pamphlet that welcomes a worker into this scene by saying you're part of a big happy family. It's bizarre! Workers know better! So wisdom of the workers themselves say, if that's the name of the game, then we'll play it. And guess what? We'll beat you at it. And so a whole value system comes into existence, much like in the Army or in the Marine Corps or in a prison, that says, can you beat the company? You're some kind of anti-hero. You know, gold breaking, look what I got away with. See? Minor theft. I stole an entire truck from this company over a period of 15 years, part by part, by carrying it out inside my trouser leg. I become a hero for beating the system. Because the workers understand that they are not part of that system, that they are less valued than the machines that make it up. Now, I'm proposing a world of work that says to workers something much different. It says to them, you're honest. It says to workers, you're responsible. It says to workers, you're important to us. And it says it to workers in this way, get rid of those cyclone fences. Throw out those punch clocks. Give the security guards a decent, rewarding job to do. Take off the firearms that they wear on their hips. Tell the workers, here's the production problem. How do you think we ought to solve it? Engage their energies, their imagination, their humanness. Construct a reward system that tracks in their contribution in visible ways to their compensation. And what we're talking about is a sane world of work, the greatest product of which will be not automobiles or washing machines or detergents, but a sane society. We've all heard people say, ah, the kids, they don't want to work anymore. Workers have lost their pride of craftsmanship. All of these misstate the reality. I submit to you the work ethic has not been repealed, but it's been very substantially amended. And it has always been amended through time. The work ethic simply is concerning the answer to the question, why work? Why work? If we look at the answers that have been developed in the United States in the course of the 200 plus years of our history, you'll find that the colonial work ethic was based on the Protestant ethic articulated by John Calvin, among others, that said, you work in order to save your immortal soul. The person of wealth bears upon him the manifest expression of God's pleasure as a reward for his thrift and his industry. The person who is poor carries the visible punishment of God for his sloth, sinfulness, indigence. And that's a pretty dynamic kind of work ethic. You know, the wrath of God himself. Why work? I want to work to get to heaven. Not to work is to go to hell. And people were highly motivated. That tend to merge into a kind of domestic work ethic developed during the period of the westward expansion. It was a restless, virile, adventuresome ethic that said that work means the conquering of the wilderness, the excitement, personal gain, the breaking of the prairie to the plow, the opening of new trade routes, the discovery of precious metals, the planting of new orchards in rich valleys, the frontier spirit. The frontier spirit and the Protestant work ethic were pretty much the indigenous work ethic in this country up to the time of the immigration from Europe. The immigrants had a distinctly different kind of answer to the question, why work? Most of the immigrant peoples that came to our shores had a collectivist or cooperative work ethic. The Scandinavians, for instance, those fishing villages, the fleets that set forth, they were all co-op fleets. A portion of the catch was set aside, very carefully gleaned from the harvest of the seas, in order to buy new equipment, to maintain that equipment that was already possessed. Individual families didn't own a boat. The village owned them. It's a cooperative venture. The Jews that came from Eastern Europe, they came from the shtetl, that kind of cooperative village economy that we saw portrayed in Fiddler on the Roof. The workers from southern Italy, from terrible poverty, nonetheless came from a sharing culture. And what they did when they came to this country to set up all kinds of co-ops, burial societies, insurance societies, settlement houses, and trade unions. And they were on a collision course with rugged individualism, theologically expressed work ethics. And that helps explain why America had one of the bloodiest trade union histories of any industrial society in the history of the human condition. Because these two entirely contrasting ethical systems roared down a track and met collision course head on. And out of that collision, we had a new work ethic preeminent in this country. That was the immigrant work ethic. It contained some of the Protestant notion of the postponement of personal satisfaction, but for a different reason. Not to save the person, but to save the family. And regardless of the language in which it was expressed, whether spoken in French or German or Yiddish, Scandinavian, Italian, Greek, whatever, it still came down to this. I don't mind working my ass off because my kids are going to have it better. The idea that work was ennobling because it had such an enormously useful and unselfish purpose. The advancement of the family, the tribe, the culture, the race. You see, wow, that's something worth working for. Work had great heroic stature, even though it was life-shortening, health-threatening, frustrating. But it had a great significance because a person lived beyond themselves in doing this work. The kids were going to have it better. 1946 represented a genuine watershed in human affairs in these United States and subsequently throughout the entire world. And that watershed was a direct consequence of World War II. In World War II, we had an explosion in new technology, undreamed of and unparalleled in human experience. It came largely because we had to rationalize, we had to break jobs down into small component units, rationalize them, in order that we could get blacks and women and other minorities into the world of work when 18 million Caucasian males were sent into the armed forces. Now, the rationalizing of work taught us that people that we used to identify as marginal or unemployable could be enormously productive. The second development was the marrying of a computer to a production process. Norbert Wiener started all of this at MIT when he married a computer to an anti-aircraft gun in World War II. And then other bright people said that if you can marry a computer to an anti-aircraft gun, you can combine a computer with well nigh any kind of production process. And this was done, and the age of automation was on us. Now, what does this really mean to the work ethic? It meant that with this enormous cornucopia of plenty, materialism rampant, that it became irrelevant to say, how do I work my ass off because my kid is going to have it better? Because now it was entirely possible, in fact desirable, that the worker had it better and his kid had it better also. Virtually have your cake and eat it. So workers, through the other parallel development that came at that point in time, installment credit for working people, easy credit terms for everybody, which was essential in order to market the product of this horn of plenty that we have discovered. We started on the next significant work ethic, which has been called a things ethic. Again, what do we talk about with an ethic? It's an answer to the question, why work? The answer for the next generation became, you work in order to get things. First, you can manhandle a split level, or a rambler in a working man's suburb, or in a middle-income district within the metropolitan area. Worker can own his own private chariot. Then he's not anything unless he has two of them. Who are you? You're supposed to have a couple of cars. Two family cars was a standard of whether you were arrived and were a person of any consequence at all. Television, then two television. And people were made to feel worthwhile in terms of the things that they possessed. That was the measure of their value. The more you had, obviously, the greater worth you were in the human pecking order. And so people were caught up for a whole generation in what has been called the hog economy, operating on a things worth work ethic. Young people started to say, we really don't see our parents happy in this scramble for things. We don't think that life is all about punching in at 6:30 in the morning and punching out at 4:30 at night and doing this for 40 years and retiring at age 65. To what? 3 years of really living it up riotously from a wheelchair? There was a shoddiness to the texture of this lifestyle at worst. At best, it was just irrelevant. It was making of people small cogs in an elaborate, impersonal system that didn't recognize their humanness. And so the things economy we started to get out of, first of all, when more and more kids, young people, chose not to enter the world of work for as long as they could avoid it. They postponed it by going to colleges and universities. They postponed it by going into extended adolescences and refusing to grow up as defined by their parents. Some entered a counterculture, some into a drug culture, but essentially a search for alternative lifestyles than the one that so dehumanized you. Then we started to see dropouts from, of all places, the executive level. Those who had achieved most of the rewards of the things culture. Executive dropouts. They're saying at age 50, I'm dropping out. I'm going to start enjoying myself. I'm going to track a second career. Then we saw a really exciting growth in people who were looking for something else to do with their lives. People want work to be a place where they can be fully human and fully alive. Now, the intermediate technology calls for the restoration of opportunities to express human capacity in work. The specific forms of intermediate technology which restores content to jobs will mean that we'll have more worker self-governance, more worker self-direction, more team concepts. The manager will be one who releases human energies by assisting workers in the whole process of decision-making on how a job should be done. Why work? Work because it is rewarding to you as a human being. Work is a way in which you can express yourself, in which you can grow, in which you can utilize your human capacities. The world of work is a human place to reside.
You've been listening to a remix version of SCAN, an electronic sweep of the horizon discovering God's activity in the world. We featured Jack Flagler on the meaning of work. SCAN is a production of Select Learning, a continuing education program of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.